You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you today, Tuesday, December 6th, is the anniversary of the deadliest industrial accident in the nation's history. The Monongah coal mine explosion in West Virginia in 1907 on this day killed over 300 men and boys who were working in that coal mine. Coincidentally, in the news today, we are finding that the Massey mine explosion, Massey has been purchased by another company, and that company is apparently cutting a deal with the feds and the local authorities. There is a possibility, according to the Charleston Gazette, that former Massey executives could still be subject to criminal liability. I'm not holding my breath. But this settlement basically says that the criminal charges, $200 million that they're going to pay if the news reports are right, and this is just, you know, kind of coming out. It'll come out over the next day or two. But it looks like it's pretty solid. $200 million is being paid. A company that, you know, I mean, for the, you know, this is chicken feed. Right? This is nothing. $200 million they're going to pay, and it's going to settle both civil and criminal penalties against the company. And, you know, I mean, this is the issue, I think, of our day. And here's how this ties into the Occupy Wall Street movement. Here's how this ties into the, you know, why President Obama doesn't have as much enthusiasm behind, or the Democratic Party in general. Why did they, you know, why did the Tea Party do so well in the 2010 elections? Why is the Republican field, why is nobody excited about anybody in the Republican field except Ron Paul? And there's a lot of excitement around Ron Paul. Why is it? Well, it's because we have created something in the last 30 years that is like the new chalice, the new sacred, you know, the new blood and body of Christ, the new sacred wafer, the new sacred activity. And it's called making money. Jimmy Carter famously walked to his inaugural ball and had a low-key event, you know, not particularly expensive. He was followed by Ronald Reagan, who famously went, you know, by car, and everybody was dressed out in their finest gowns and you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, probably millions of dollars worth of jewelry. And suddenly bling was in, right? And starting in 1981 in this nation, we changed a fundamental value system that had held since the Great Depression, when we got it that the excesses of the 1920s, when everybody thought that making money was sacred, and then it crashed the country and ultimately the world. From that time, from the Great Depression up until 1981, it was like, you know, okay, you know, there are people among us who make money, you know, entrepreneurs, business people, corporate CEOs. But they do it in a reasonable fashion. You know, the family doctor in the 1970s and 1980s was making an okay income, but was not a multimillionaire or not even a millionaire. 1950s and 60s, they were doing house calls. They, you know, 10, 20 bucks for the extra house call. We changed everything. We have changed everything in the last 30 years, and we have made the pursuit of money the sacred object, the holy grail of the United States. So much so that if you earn your living by working, and you go to a restaurant and you order your food, you've got to pay for it with your own money. But if you earn your living making money as a business person, and you go to a restaurant and you order lunch, taxpayers will pick up part of the tab. Business lunches are tax-deductible expenses. Explain to me why we, the people, should be picking up part of the cost of lunch for somebody who's simply a business person. I mean, just think about that for a minute. Businesses can dump their trash. If you took your trash, if you took the trash from your house and you took it out and just poured it in the street, they would come after you. But if you're a refinery run by the Koch brothers or somebody else, ExxonMobil, whatever, and you're pouring chemicals, cancer-causing chemicals, asthma-causing chemicals, environment-altering compounds like carbon dioxide, if you're pouring that stuff into the air, as long as you do it within the limits that are set in the negotiations between your lobbyists and your congresspeople, you pay nothing. You can dump your trash in the air or in the water. You're running a nuclear power plant, you're dumping all that hot water into the rivers and lakes of this country. No problem. We'll subsidize it. We the people, the tax, the little people will pay for it. So Joe Markham, who died on April 5th, 2010, 31 years old. Anybody going to go to jail for his death at the Upper Big Branch mine? No. Stephen Hara, 40 years old, died that day. Anybody going to go to jail for his death? No. Joel Price, 55 years old, died at the Upper Big Branch mine. Anybody going to go to? Nah, it doesn't look like it. Rex Mullins, he's 50 years old. Corey Davis, he was 20 years old, died in that blast. By the way, the United Mine Workers Union has put together about 120-page report on this thing, a report on the Upper Big Branch mine disaster titled Industrial Homicide. So, you know, I talked about if you dump your trash, no problem. If you're a big corporation and you're making money. If you kill people and you're a big corporation and you kill them in the course of making, well, you know, figure out a way to overlook that. But if you kill your next door neighbor because he, shot your dog or something, no, sorry, you're going to go to jail. And to top the whole thing off, if you're making money like the owners of Massey Mine are now, if you're making money with money, and you take that, you know, personally, you take your income as dividends and interest, particularly as dividends, which is increasingly how CEOs and wealthy people pay themselves. Half of all dividends in the United States last year were paid to the top 0.1% of Americans. If you take your income income as dividends, you have a special income tax rate. You don't pay the normal income tax rate. You pay the capitalist gains income tax rate. Maximum 15%. Maximum 15%. And you can get away with murder, literally. And you can dump your trash in wherever you want, in the air, in the water, in the soil. I mean, if it's fracking, pumping toxic chemicals that otherwise would have had to been paid for to dispose of down into the ground. There's something fundamentally wrong here that we need to be talking about and fixing.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So it looks like they're coming to a resolution with this Massey Mine disaster. Ain't nobody going to jail. Is that right?
Oh, I've been a coal miner all my life, laying down track in the hole. Got a back like ironwood, bent by the wind, but veins as blue as the coal. But veins as blue as the coal.
So today, the anniversary of 1907 of one of the worst industrial accidents in the history of the United States, a massive coal mine explosion. And today is the day that Alpha, is the new company, is announcing that, or may be announcing, it apparently has reached a settlement with the U.S. government that crimes, yeah, okay, some crimes were committed, over 300 safety violations, led to the death of, 29 people, but we'll pay $200 million to make it go away. I wonder if that's tax deductible. I mean, it's mind-boggling. Meanwhile, speaking of dumping your trash in the air, the year 2000, between 2009 and 2010, the numbers are in. Carbon emissions worldwide went up 5.9%, the largest one-year jump since the Industrial Revolution started three centuries ago. They're meeting in Durban, South Africa right now to talk about this. This is serious stuff. It's huge. Occupy Wall Street is going off in a new direction. They're occupying foreclosed homes. This day of action today, 25 cities across America, including New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, and others, to occupy Wall Street patriots are going to take to the suburbs and the city centers and find homes that are being foreclosed, have been foreclosed, are either homeowners in need of help, hey, please occupy my front yard to keep the sheriff away, or homes that are empty. Because of the crimes of the banksters, who, by the way, are also not going to jail. And the banksters are causing people to die. People are dying because they've lost their jobs and they've lost their health insurance. And as a consequence of that, they're not getting medical services that they need. They're dying because they've lost their jobs and the stresses on their families are jacking up divorce rates and spousal abuse and child abuse rates. And these things are leading to deaths. They're leading to suicides. They're leading to homicides. They're leading to conditions that shorten people's lives. Stress shortens people's lives. This is absolutely $7.7 trillion we gave these guys, these banksters. And they made $14 billion in profit on it. And we didn't even know about it. The president didn't even know about it. I mean, the Fed just does this stuff. So Occupy Wall Street, let's take that $7 trillion back, home by home, person by person. The right-wing narrative on this, of course, is, the whole problem was that the government was encouraging banks to loan money to people who couldn't afford to have loans. Well, first of all, the entire subprime mortgage market was about $1.7 trillion, which is a fraction. I mean, we could have taken every single subprime mortgage in the United States and paid it off. Problem solved, right? If that was the problem. But that wasn't the problem. The problem was that the banksters had taken that $1.7 trillion worth of mortgages and turned it into about $600 to $800 trillion worth of bets. And it's the bets that were going south. Of course, the conservatives don't want to talk about that. They're not going to talk about that on Fox News and GOP TV or conservative talk radio. Today in Los Angeles, the city council is voting tonight. The city council of Los Angeles is going to be voting on whether or not they should encourage the congressional representatives, the legislative representatives of that state and of the nation, of that state representing the nation, senators, members of Congress, whether they should encourage them to end corporate personhood. Corporate personhood being one of the shields that allows corporations like this to get away literally with murder and just pay a small fine. So if you're listening to me in L.A. and you can get down to City Hall and check that thing out, that's a big deal. We will be talking about that in the third hour of our program today. By the way, Steve Justino of Move to Amend is going to be with us. And also how Occupy the Courts is coming up on January 20th, Cornell West and I are going to be occupying the U.S. Supreme Court. You're invited. We'll tell you more about that. And Dick Cheney's Halliburton is in trouble. Apparently, according to BP and Transocean, one of the main reasons that oil rig blew up, killing 11 people. Here we are again, people dying and nobody going to jail for it. Killing 11 people, the Macondo well, down in the Gulf of Mexico, was because of the lousy job, the crappy job that Halliburton did in putting cement around the outside of the well casing. Well, guess what? Halliburton has destroyed the evidence. They've even destroyed the computer models that they had that showed that they might have been the ones responsible. Why is it everything Dick Cheney touches turns to criminal activity? Meanwhile, NASA scientists have found another solar system, a planet in another solar system. It's called Kepler-22b. It's much like Earth. Apparently has water. It surrounds the sun about like our sun. It's bigger than Earth, so everything will weigh more, but that's about it. So different kinds of life forms might emerge, or at least physically looking different. But the average temperature is 71 degrees. So now the libertarians have a place where they can go and create a libertarian society. Because they've never been able to successfully create a libertarian society on planet Earth. There has never been a country run on libertarian lines that has succeeded. Never. But they keep trying. They keep trying to make us that way. They're trying to make Europe that way. Oh, we need austerity. We need to cut government programs. We need to let's slash our way to profitability. Let's slash our way to prosperity. Right. And meanwhile, let's give more tax cuts to millionaires and billionaires. Right. Go to Kepler-22b. Sounds like a plan to me. Back with your thoughts on the news of the day and some more of mine right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
How do we change this system that holds making money sacred above human life? To make it even all the more, welcome back, 34 minutes past the hour, to make it even all the more insane, you get Donald Trump, this is clip 7, Jacob, Donald Trump coming out and saying, oh yeah, child labor laws, we don't need those things, yeah, let the poor kids clean the bathrooms in the school, it'll teach them their place after all. I mean, this is the subtext, right? I'm supplying the subtext. I'm not quoting Donald Trump, but this is the subtext of his message and Newt's message. Poor kids in school, let them clean the toilets. It'll teach them something. And it'll teach them a work ethic. Well, it'll teach them their place in society, after all. They are getting a little uppity, aren't they? Here's Donald Trump.
It was a great honor to have Newt up here. Amazing how well he's doing and how it's really resonated with so many people. He did mention if I could do something for some of the kids in very, very poor schools throughout the city. I thought it was a great idea. We call it an apprenticeship. And so we're going to be picking 10 young, wonderful children, and we're going to make them apprentice. We're going to have a little fun with it. And I think it's going to be something that's going to really prove results. But it was Newt's idea, and I thought it was a great idea.
So we have two memes here that we want to share with the poor children of America. And I mean literally poor. The underprivileged children of America, the one out of four children in America who only is able to get fed because of food stamps. And that message is, A, your place in life is to be cleaning the toilets of your peers. Your more well-off peers, because you need to be taught the work ethic. And B, there's this cool lottery thing. And out of the, you know, couple million of you out there, we're going to pick 10, and one of them is going to hit the jackpot on Donald Trump's reality show. So work toward that jackpot, because that's, you know, forget about studies, forget about, you know, the aspirations. There's a jackpot out there that can be won. You get this? Newt Gingrich is never going to be president. Newt Gingrich is not even going to be the nominee of the Republican Party. I know they're all getting real quiet right now about criticizing him and things, but, you know, he is not, up until the last week, he has not been running for president. He has been running a book tour. just like Herman Cain was running a book tour. Just like Michelle Bachmann was basically running a fundraising campaign so that she could get herself reelected to the House of Representatives. Because her race last year, 2 years ago, at $11 million, was the most expensive House race in the history of the United States. Or at least the most expensive that year. There may have been some other one that was historically massive, more expensive, but she spent more money to get herself elected than anybody else did. In a little district in Minnesota. So she needs a lot of money. Did you see this on YouTube? It's going viral. Of this, she's at a book signing. Michelle Bachmann's at a book signing. Of course she's at a book signing, right? She's selling books. She's cashing in. Newt's cashing in. Herman's cashing in. They're all cashing in. The only one not cashing in and who's seriously running for president is Mitt Romney. And John Huntsman. Who both make the right-wing conservatives tremble because they're Mormons. And they're moderates. And they're rational. And they're Republicans sort of in the mold of Richard Nixon. In terms of policies and positions. As opposed to crazies like Ronald Reagan or George W. Bush. But in any case, Newt is out there doing this. Dick Morris, may I suck your toe, please? Dick Morris, this is one of the reasons why when you visit a website and sign up, I'll tell you right up front, on our website at tomhartman.com, when you register to be on our website, to participate, to have a blog, to participate in the message boards, to be in the chat rooms, we do not distribute that list to anybody. We say right on the website, that's our privacy policy, your name is not shared with anybody. But beware of people who are saying, hey, give me your, you know, text me a message so I can catch your cell phone number, because those can be sold for a lot of money. You can sell cell phone numbers, text message numbers for, you know, $5 a whack. Or sign up on my website for this poll that you can take or something, you know, whatever. Check their privacy policy and make sure that they're not going to resell your cell phone number or your email address. Because here's Dick Morris basically, and apparently he felt that he had to say this or he could possibly have the force of the law coming down on him. Or maybe he's bragging about it. I don't know. But clip number 10, Jacob.
And then the other thing, the only time money paid chain passes hands is that you may be surprised, but I have this website, dickmorris.com.
I know, I've been there.
And I have 500,000 people who've signed up to get my emails.
Right.
So the candidates often pay my website to send a mailing to them.
Okay.
In the same sense that they pay Fox News to run an ad.
So have candidates that you don't consult done this or no? Or just the one, or you don't remember?
Actually, Cain has, Bachmann has, Romney has not, Gingrich, I think, has.
Okay.
And I think Ron Paul has.
Yeah. Well, it's never going to happen coming off our website. And for some reason in the right wing, and this gets back to my whole point of, you know, making money is sacred in America, and it means that people who make money can kill people without going to jail. It means that people who make money can destroy the planet without being held accountable, without having to pay the expenses of it. People who make money pay a special tax rate of only 15%, the capitalist gains tax rate, income tax rate. That people who make money get their meals subsidized by the taxpayers because they're tax-deductible business expense. Tell me how weird this is. Bill in Longview, Washington. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Tom, I'd just like to relate a little history to you. My mother was a coal miner's daughter, mm-hmm. and her father was killed in a coal mine. It's called Jamison Coal Mine in western Pennsylvania,
right.
Somewhere around 1933. She was about 6 years old. She had two sisters and a brother, and, of course, no father when they were young children. I never knew my grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
There's a part of my history missing.
Right.
I don't know what my point is exactly, but there was no compensation. Actually, it was kind of a very common occurrence back then.
Yeah, it was. If I may supply a point, and you can tell me if I'm off base here, Bill, it's that because people making money, even when it involved killing other people, has been sanctioned by this country for so long that you lost the extraordinary and wonderful experience that I was fortunate enough to have, which is to know your grandfather.
Correct.
And that's a sad and tragic thing. And thank you, Bill, for calling and sharing that story with us.
Not only that, my mother doesn't remember him very much either.
Right, and your mother doesn't remember her father. And thank you, Bill. And on this day in 1907, 300 men and boys died in the Monongah coal mine explosion, the worst in the history of the United States. And this is the day that they're announcing that they're going to settle the Massey thing for $200 million, more or less. Nobody's going to go to jail in all probability. They're settling both the criminal and the civil parts. There's some members of the family who are saying, hey, wait a minute, this sucks. And so anyway, let me get back to some of these other issues here. Rama in Santa Fe. Hey, Rama, what's up?
I just wanted to say that this is unconscionable with the fact of this Massey coal mine disaster. Our sovereign militia forces need to go to Washington. 8 heads in a duffel bag. Arrest. It is time. Now.
Okay, Rama. Thank you. I'm not ready to send armed people to Washington, D.C., but I do believe that we need to be changing our political discourse, and we need to be changing our laws, and we need to be holding these people accountable, frankly. Steve, in Santa Rosa, California, listening on Green 960. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom, it is a privilege to get on the phone with you. You know, I was listening to you about the coal mine disaster, and this is the anniversary of it, and you were listing off names of young people that died in it. And since the Citizens United case, and the Supreme Court decided personhood for corporations, how come we cannot go after these corporations for their accountability now that they have personhood?
Well, the reality is that we haven't gone after these corporations since the rise of the Gilded Age, since the 1870s. Since
the
railroad
era. Has been changed and they have personhood, we couldn't go after them before. Now they have the accountability of a personhood.
They don't really have personhood. What they have is personhood in the context of political free speech. And there was an AT&T case that was adjudicated by the Supreme Court just a few months ago on the Fourth Amendment, where AT&T was claiming that they would be embarrassed if their secrets were made known, and as a person they had Fourth Amendment rights of privacy. And the Supreme Court shot that down. So, you know, personhood is not it's not absolute. They haven't become just human beings like you and me. What they have been given is the right to control our political dialogue. And that is something that is fundamentally wrong. We will be back with more of your thoughts and mine right after this. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And you can check out, drop into our free live chat room. It runs 24/7. Regardless of when you're listening to us, there's probably somebody there you could have a conversation with. TomHartman.com. Talk media for the rest of us. Tom Hartman with you 9 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Doug in Chicago. Hey, Doug, what's up?
Hey, Tom. It's nice to talk to you. This is my third time calling you. The first two times, you're really rude to me. You kind of threw me off a bit because I'm a real big fan of the show and of you.
Are you going to make me rude to you again, Doug?
I hope not. I mean, I don't disagree with you on anything.
What's your point?
Well, I was trying to tell you about my mother and her her ability to help the occupiers. And the first time you kind of palmed me off really quickly to your producer, who never followed up with me. And the second time you hung up right in the middle.
Right.
Of my sentence.
And Doug, I got it that your mom has this thing and she wants to promote it and you want to promote it to our listeners, and you know, good luck on that. What I would suggest is that you post it on the blog at tomhartman.com. You know, individual promotional things. You know, we get people who call who say, hey, I've got a great new book out. Will you put me on the air? Hey, I've got a person who wants to do something. I've got all the, you know, all these kinds of things. Post them on the blog. You're absolutely welcome to. But individual promotions, no thanks. Ray in Dartmouth, Mass. Hey, Ray, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
I'm fine. I'm apparently discourteous, but other than that, I'm fine.
I'm not going to promote anything other than my ideas. So
okay, go for it.
The Republicans like to say that progressives are anti-business, but yet it is their free trade, free market policies that have driven down the paychecks of average working Americans. And now you and I both know that businesses, small, medium, and large, need a healthy middle class with a healthy paycheck in order to increase their profits.
Right. Even rich people need that if they want to stay in the United States.
Exactly. So my point is by driving down the wages of working people in the middle and driving down the wages of even poor people, you're putting more pressure on the profitability of your local community businesses. So, in essence, that in itself is more anti-business than any tax or regulation that progressives put forward.
Yeah, totally.
That's really my point.
Totally agree with you. And the simple evidence of it is that 30 years of Reaganomics has destroyed the middle class, and the last 10 years of Bushonomics and super big tax cuts for corporations and for very wealthy individuals created net negative jobs. I mean, it's like, you know, where are the jobs? The proof of it is just look at what has happened over the last 30 years. Very well said, Ray. Thank you very much for the call. It's pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing. Dave in Portland. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I feel by spending so much time on the Newt Gingrich child labor story, you're ignoring the big, big story, which is all of his ethics problems that he's had through the last couple of years, even including a $300,000 fine that he was assessed by the Ethics Committee, correct?
Yeah, and there's an article over in Alternet right now called 13 Reasons Why Newt Gingrich Won't Win the Nomination. And I almost went off on that from his six-year affair with his third wife while he was still married to his second wife, his being pushed to the back Air Force One, the $300,000 ethics fine violation. That was the result, by the way, of Jim McDermott putting out a tape recording of Newt basically committing a crime over a cell phone that was illegally recorded by a couple in Florida. Newt sued Jim McDermott, and so Bill Clinton and I went to Seattle to do a fundraiser for Jim to pay for the legal fees because Newt was suing him. But the bottom line, you're absolutely right. Newt Gingrich has so much baggage and so much stuff in his past and his present, for that matter. I mean, you know, the money he takes as speaking fees, in quotes, and not being a lobbyist and whatnot, that, you know, there's no way he's going to be the Republican nominee. And if he is, there's no way he's going to win the presidency. I think the Republicans, barring some last minute, you know, Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio or Chris Christie or somebody like that jumping into the race, the Republicans are probably going to end up with Mitt Romney, who, by the way, and thank you for that, Dave, who, by the way, has now received financial support officially from 10%, more than 10% of the nation's billionaires. Mitt Romney has now received financial support from more than 10% of the nation's billionaires. Andy in Washington, D.C. Hey, Andy, what's up? Andy? Andy's not there. Okay. Larry in New Orleans. Hey, Larry, what's on your mind today? Larry?
Last week, yes, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Okay. Last week you were talking about automation in the workplace and how productivity is outpacing wages. Ravi Batra talks about demand no longer tracking supply. Now, you've mentioned that one obvious fix for this imbalance is a shorter work week because that would create wage inflation because of the increased demand for labor. Well, let's fast forward to the end of the movie. To keep this balance, eventually we would need a shorter and shorter work week. So we go from 40 hours to 30 hours to 20 hours and so on. As we approach a zero-hour work week, we approach a resource-based economy, a leisure society where material wealth is a given. Now, as you know, Tom, there are currently three factors of production: labor, capital, and resources. As human labor becomes obsolete, so does capital, because without
jobs,
people won't have money.
It's not going to happen. human labor is not going to become obsolete. No matter how automated something is, there's still human labor. Somebody has to come up with the idea for that machine. Somebody has to design that machine. Somebody has to jig test
that
machine.
Well, no, but they actually have machines that design machines today.
I know that, but they're still not capable of running without people. And should the day arrive, you know, this science fiction world that you're describing, then we could talk about that. But then do you really want to have an economy that's purely extractive?
Well, no, but the point is that labor is becoming obsolete. I mean, that's why, there was automation that came into manufacturing.
No, some types of labor are becoming obsolete. Other types of labor are becoming more important. There are fewer people. People no longer make buggy whips, they make cars. There's fewer people making cars because of robots, but there's more people who are developing things that you can use in the cars. I hate to sound like Tom Friedman, and in fact, I don't want to. I agree with you that labor is becoming less and less of a factor in industrial production. But that doesn't mean that there's not going to, the demand for labor is going to go away. I get your point, but I think that your end point is not going to happen. Larry, thank you for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. One of the great mysteries of our time, frankly, and seriously, is why would anybody who has a significant stake in the future, which I think is a general and broad description, arguably of all of us, we all hope for future generations and those old enough to have children and grandchildren have a measurable and real stake in the future, but particularly young people. Why would young people support the candidacy of somebody who says that we should completely do away with Social Security, end it. We should do away with Medicare, end it. We should not have a national health care system. The churches will pay for your medical bills. You ever seen those cans in the 7-Elevens, so-and-so needs a lung transplant, please put 10 cents in, we're trying to raise $100,000. They never do. I mean, they never succeed in raising the money. It's like, why would anybody support the candidacy? Why would young people in huge numbers support the candidacy of Ron Paul or any libertarian? I refer to libertarians as Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid. And I think conventional wisdom is it's the smoke dope and get laid part that gets all the young people excited. I think that is, well, in fact, our guest, David Sirota, thinks that that's not only simplistic, but insulting. David, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks, Tom.
DavidSirota.com, of course. You can find all of David's great work. He's a host on AM 750 in Denver in the morning, as well as a best-selling author. Your most recent book, in fact, is Back to Our Future, and a syndicated columnist. So, David, tell me, why would anybody support, a 20-something or even a 30-something support Ron Paul?
Well, I don't want to fully discount what you said about drug policy reform. Ron Paul is one of the only candidates who's run for president in recent memory, who's got a serious shot at becoming president, who's talked honestly about the drug war, and I think there's something to that. I think young people, in particular, understand that the drug war, as it's being conventionally waged, is not a good expenditure of resources. However, simply saying it's just because of Paul's position on drugs ignores the really striking difference that we see in polls in terms of how young people feel about foreign policy. Now, there was a new study out from the Pew Research Center which found that two-thirds of millennials, those are between 18 and 29 years old, say that relying too much on military force to defeat terrorism creates hatred that leads to more terrorism. And this is in stark contrast to the older generation, which has the much more conventional views on foreign policy. Ron Paul has been one of the only candidates, if not the only candidate, to really make as one of the central parts of his platform. The idea that militarism is not only a colossal waste of resources, but doesn't make us any safer as a country. And when you put that up next to young people's views that are much the same, and you start to see that perhaps foreign policy is a driving force behind why Ron Paul has such a followership among young people.
So, you know, we've seen throughout our lifetimes, and I think probably throughout the history of American politics, people voting for candidates on which with whom they may disagree on many issues. And certainly the history of the modern day Republican Party is people supporting Republicans who are going to just economically screw them because those Republicans are, you know, have appealed successfully to a single issue, whether it's abortion or guns or God or, you know, gays or whatever it may be, that this foreign policy issue could be a single issue that would cause young people to ignore, overlook, not take seriously, or not even, you know, really stop and pay careful attention to Ron Paul's positions on what the kind of America we would have, setting aside the, you know, if we stop being empire, but beyond that.
Yeah, I think it's a package of things. I think when people say, well, you know, a young voter might say, well, listen, I agree with him on drug policy reform. I agree with him on civil liberties. Oh, and I really agree with him on foreign policy as well. Those are three pretty big things.
They are.
I think kind of the media has written Ron Paul's foreign policy views out of that story because those foreign policy views are so outside of the political mainstream. I think they're well within the American mainstream, but in terms of the political elite in this country. And I think one other thing that's really important about Ron Paul's candidacy, I think there's an argument to be made that the issues that he is particularly, in my own personal political perspective, good on, like foreign policy, like civil liberties, like drug policy reform, happen to be the very issues that a president has among the most amount of unilateral control over. A president can't alone make huge economic policy. He needs Congress. For better or for worse, a president can simply decide with the stroke of a pen on whether to go to war or not, and on how to use federal law enforcement agencies with respect to civil liberties. So I think there may be a deeper understanding that say, well, listen, you know, on the issues that a president can control, Ron Paul is actually not so bad.
It's very interesting. You know, Thomas Jefferson nearly brought down the Constitution in this battle that he had with Alexander Hamilton and others over whether or not we should have standing armies during time of peace. And the first draft of the Second Amendment, and you read his letters with Madison, you know, where he was saying, I'm going to pull the Virginia delegation if you don't do this. The first draft essentially said, there shall be no standing army during times of peace, and in order to protect the public good, and then the language of the Second Amendment, in order to have a well-ordered militia, the right of citizens to bear arms shall not be abridged. The idea being that everybody would basically be a member of a National Guard kind of thing, where they show up for training for a week or a year, and then, you know, and in fact, George Washington had the first mandate was that you had to buy a gun if you were in the militia. I mean, you know, it's during his administration. But Jefferson, when he came into office, he inherited an army that was 300,000 men strong. And by the time he left office 8 years later, it was down to 6,000 men. I mean, he just whittled away that army because he just thought it shouldn't exist during times of peace. He was kind of the Ron Paul of his day in that regard.
Yeah, and again, I want to be clear. I don't subscribe to Ron Paul's economic orthodoxy at all. But I do think it's important to acknowledge that, especially on matters of war and peace, in which Ron Paul has been so crystal clear and has made so central to his candidacy, understanding that in the context of the modern American presidency, where those decisions are made, unfortunately, in my estimation, almost unilaterally by the president himself or herself, it stands to reason that young people are saying, listen, I don't like either of the parties right now. I'm not happy with either of the parties. But hey, here's one guy who is real serious about getting us out of war. And right. if he gets elected, he has the unilateral authority to do that.
But virtually the entire progressive caucus, which is, I believe, all Democrats right now, and typically always has been, in the House and in the Senate, virtually that entire caucus is pretty much in line with Ron Paul's perspective on the war on drugs, and in line with his perspective on foreign policy. So how does that get missed by these young people?
Well, I don't think it's missed. I mean, I think the fact is that the Progressive Caucus is very different from the Obama administration. The Obama administration has been as bad in many cases, or even worse than the Bush administration on some of these key questions. I mean, look, the Bush administration, let's take civil liberties just as one example. The Bush administration asserted the, at that time, unprecedented right to indefinitely detain American citizens if they were accused of terrorism. The Obama administration has now asserted the right to execute American citizens in the same circumstance.
And did so just a few weeks ago.
Exactly, which makes indefinite detention seem like a cakewalk, which is incredible. So I think that that what's going on here is that there is a separation right now in the perception of a lot of young people, that there's the Democratic Party, maybe there's the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, there's also the Obama administration, which is different from that, and then there's this campaign called the Ron Paul for President campaign, and all those things are very different.
Right. In the 10 seconds we have left, David, do you think that Ron Paul will run as a Libertarian when he loses the Republican nomination?
I don't think he'll do it. I would like to see him do it. I think it would bring real issues into the general election.
I totally agree with you on all points. David Sirota, davidsirota.com. Thank you, David.
Thanks, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So what do you think about Ron Paul? You know, would you vote for him for president? And why? Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you, your media support group for We the People. And Brian in Asheville, North Carolina, listening on WPVM. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I am a 26-year-old progressive who will not vote for Ron Paul, and I actually called last week to bring up some questions of what's going on with this whole phenomena, because here I have a lot of friends that support Ron Paul, and I start telling them, well, hey, do you want a free market? And they don't really know what that means.
Yeah.
And, I've read Ron Paul's in the Fed, and I sort of think it got really redundant, but I think he means well, and I think that, he wants small business to succeed. But the problem is that he's such an ideologue that he won't stop big business.
Right. No, he's a libertarian. He believes that the marketplace with very, very few rules, it's like, football games without referees are going to be the very best. Well, if you're into cage fights or battles to the death, maybe. And that's really the libertarian worldview, is allow battles to the death among corporations, and you're going to end up with the largest corporations and the wealthiest people basically running the entire show. That's Ayn Rand's vision for America. That's natural selection. That's Darwinian economics. That's let only the strong survive and everybody else dies. And when he was asked, well, what are you going to do about a 30-something who's got brain damage and doesn't have insurance? And basically his answer was, well, maybe the churches will pay for it or the community. But somebody in the audience yelled, let them die. I mean, that's the libertarian perspective. And David is right that Ron Paul is taking a lot of good positions with regard to foreign policy, with regard to the drug wars, with regard to civil liberties, with regards to consensual adult behavior. He wants to end laws against prostitution, among other things. And, those are all things that I get and that I support, but I think that most progressives support. And this is the weird thing about libertarianism, is it's this hybrid of the social libertarianism of progressives and liberals, along with the economic conservatism of the traditional Republican Party. And if you don't realize that at the end of the day, you can talk all you want about, ending wars and everything else, but at the end of the day, when the money and the power end up in the hands of the large defense contractors, that's who's going to win, even if you're a good president. And I think, the history has shown us that. Brian, thank you for sharing your perspective with us. Appreciate it. Sean in Battleground, Washington. Hey, Sean, what's up?
Tom, it's been said that the lottery is a tax on the ignorant, and I would take that a step further. I would say America itself is a tax on the ignorant, and I think Ron Paul kind of exemplifies that whole attitude. He would eliminate minimum wage.
Yes.
But America's
and child labor laws.
Right. And more and more Americans are inculcated, even in public high schools and middle schools, in these kind of junior entrepreneur, junior capitalist classes. You know, they're taught how to manage stock portfolios and things like
that.
Right,
they're promoted by the...
It's very similar to the lottery. Everyone thinks that I'm clever enough, I'm intelligent enough, I work hard, so it's never going to be me who's going to have to depend on the minimum wage or Medicaid or Social Security or anything like that. And Ron Paul plays to that kind of infantile selfishness, that kind of narcissism that says, well, of course, I'm going to be the one that comes out on top.
Right, and that's the essence of the libertarian philosophy, and that's the essence of objectivism, of you know, Ron Paulism. Yeah, Ayn Rand, exactly. You know, exactly. Thank you. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, what's up?
Hey, Tom. We had for a long, long, long time in the Tampa Bay area this neocon going on and on and on and on and on. And I want your opinion, your honest opinion. Please don't chop me off. If you think there's some truth in what this neocon was promoting.
You're talking about a talk radio host?
Not
or a politician?
No, it was an influential person. Let me keep it on that level.
All right, fine.
Somebody that had the captive audience day to day to day. Basically, this person admitted that the Democrats want to help the poor so much, it's obvious, and he admitted it, that they were even willing to bring in illegal Mexicans to give the blacks permanently on welfare curb service. And he says the problem with that philosophy is they've destroyed the middle private sector working class to pay for it.
Yeah.
Now,
Armin, that is I am going to cut you off. That is a breathtakingly racist perspective, and for you to endorse it, I'm frankly shocked. Holly in Portland. Hey, Holly, you got a minute to the break. What's up?
Hi, Tom. You know, I would not vote for Ron Paul, even though so many of the things that you've listed are appealing. But I think as a parent, he terrifies me. And I think young people, you know, you're asking why young people are so attracted to him. I think if you're not responsible for anybody else yet, if you're still young, you're still kind of on your own.
Yeah.
I think that's a little different perspective.
Yeah, he would do away with the agency that makes sure that the toys you give your child do not contain poison.
Right, and they'd be in the Monongah mine, and they'd be dead. I mean, he would, you know.
Yeah.
It's terrifying.
Yeah, this whole ideology of deregulation of the government is too big. Government, you know, no, government is us, and government should be doing the things that government should do. And people say, well, you should run your government like a family. Well, no, it's not a family. You should run your government like a business. No, it's not a business. It's a government. It always has been, and it should govern. It should protect. You know, we the people, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, those things should be available to us. And you can't have life if you don't have access to health care. You can't have liberty if you don't have a certain minimum threshold that you can stand on so that you can, you know, get by day to day, regardless of your circumstances. And you can't have the pursuit of happiness if you don't have the first two. And those are the obligations of government. Holly, thank you for the call. Very well said. I appreciate it. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back. Tom Hartman here with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And the Occupy Wall Street movement, by the way, is moving in the direction. Today, a national day of action, 25 cities occupying foreclosed homes. Cool.
Why can't they count our votes? But they made voting machines that leave no paper trail. And why can't they count our
Why can't they even let us vote? I mean, you've got the NAACP is now going to the United Nations saying, you know, African Americans are being disenfranchised by all these right-wing Republicans running the various states where they're passing voter ID laws. I mean, it's just incredible. So, anyway.
I was gonna go to class before I got high.
Oh, it's because I got high alert. Yes, a North Carolina man is facing criminal charge. This guy, okay, you know about these, they're called, what's the phrase here? DWI Mobile Command Center. These are like, you know, stop points, DWI Mobile Command Centers, you know, where they stop everybody and say, here, you know, breathe in the breathalyzer, we're going to, and frankly, I think they're unconstitutional, but that's a whole other thing. And so 21-year-old Douglas Shane Southard was driving along, and there's a mobile DWI command center, and they're saying stop. And he was so drunk, he didn't stop. He ran right into it. The mobile command center had this big sign across that said, booze it and lose it. He lost it. Amazing. Amazing. Okay. Andy in Washington, D.C. Let's try it again, Andy. What's up?
Yeah, Mr. Comer, I wanted to say I'm from Chicago, and I'm here in D.C. For the Take Back the Capitol. And
great.
I'm sitting in my congressman's office waiting to talk to him.
Okay.
And I actually wanted to thank you because when I thought about coming, one of my main things I kept thinking was your get involved comment.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it was time to get involved and, you know, see what I could say to my congressman.
Good on you, Andy. And who's your congressman and what are you going to say?
My congressman is Joe Walsh, and I'm going to try and get a commitment out of him to not cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and to do something about jobs.
Wow. Well, good luck. Let us know how it works out, would you?
I will let you know. Thank
okay.
you very much.
Look forward to hearing back from you, Andy, and good on you for coming to Washington, D.C. and showing up at the office of your congressman. That's what we all should be doing. Jim in Newport Coast, California, listening on KTLK. Hey, Jim, what's up? Jim? No, apparently Jim's not there. Mark in Merrill, Michigan. That's twice today. Mark in Merrill, Michigan. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hi. Hey, I was at my union meeting last night, and the international office sent us a letter telling us how mostly not to support the Occupy Wall Street. We can't give overt support, but we can pass out water bottles and open up our union halls for warming stations, and I thought that was kind of cowardly. Because
well, here's the deal. Unions exist by virtue of law, okay? And they are entities that come into existence because the union people who are organizing the union file articles of incorporation essentially with the Secretary of State. And most corporations and unions are held to a higher standard, frankly, than other corporations. But most corporations, if they break the law, risk being dissolved. And so what your union is saying to you basically is that, you know, some of these Occupy Wall Street groups are technically and sometimes overtly and sometimes even intentionally and going out of their way to break laws that they consider wrong. And we honor that, and you can individually support that. But as an institution, we can't explicitly support that because that puts us at risk. And plus, there probably hasn't been a vote in your union where more than 50% of the members of the union have said, yes, please do this. And, you know, lacking that, I don't think any union would be in a position to go out and aggressively push something. So I understand that. I mean, it seems to make perfect sense to me. I think it's kind of cool that they're saying, you know, we can't support them, but you can. You know, that's a statement of support in and of itself.
Well, I wish you'd have been there last night to give that explanation because, you know, I stood up and said it was cowardly, and it just set off a big controversy.
That's unfortunate.
And I can agree to that.
Yeah, okay. Thanks a lot, Mark. Next time you can educate the folks around you. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Thank you. Eleanor in Berkeley. Hey, Eleanor, what's up?
Hi. I want to give an enthusiastic endorsement to the Occupy movement,
mm-hmm.
and especially what they're doing now, which is to focus on the foreclosed housing.
Yes, 25 cities, the national action today, occupying
yes.
foreclosed homes and occupying homes that are already both standing in the front lawns of houses where the sheriff will otherwise, you know, come in and kick people out, and occupying empty houses.
Right, but in doing so, they are going to open a problem that they haven't faced directly, and that is the aspect of decadent capitalism that you brought up a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
And occupying private property is going to bring out the worst of this capitalist system.
Yeah.
The police will come out more viciously than they did when they were occupying public property in front of city buildings.
We'll see. We'll see.
They have to be ready for that. I'm not saying they shouldn't do it. I am encouraging them to do it.
And
I think the focus has got to be on the ravages of capitalism.
Yes.
That those of us who for 60 some odd years have been talking about that, and now we're seeing it in a manifest way that we couldn't even have predicted years ago.
Yeah, I'm with you, Eleanor. And it may well be that the response will be far more ferocious. On the other hand, it may well be that the response will be, I mean, most police officers, I think, get it that we've been robbed by the banks. Of course, they're not the ones making the decisions. It's the politicians. Most politicians at the local level get it that we've been robbed by the banks. And frankly, a lot of those cops and a lot of those politicians have mortgages that are underwater. So,
well, that may be true, Tom, but the police are a paramilitary force. They are trained to do what they do and to bring out the guns and the tear gas and the tanks if necessary.
Yeah. And
in the final analysis.
Yeah. And this is over the last 30 years, we have stepped over that line, because it used to be that an army is designed to kill people and blow things up, and a police force is designed to be part of the community that protects itself. Right. And many police forces have been dancing very close to the edge of becoming military forces, thus paramilitary. And it's not a good thing for democracy. It's not a good thing for America. I think our founders are rolling over in their graves. It's not what they would have wanted. Excellent point, Eleanor. Thank you for making it. And thanks for watching us there in Berkeley. Joe in Casper, Wyoming. Hey, Joe, what's up? You're a Ron Paul supporter.
Yes, I am.
Okay. Why?
I have been for years and years and years. The libertarian viewpoint has always appealed to me. I've always, I think, since I was a young child, been a libertarian. And I think a lot of the things that you say are kind of misguided in a way.
Okay. For example?
Example, you say the social programs that he wants to get rid of. He just wants to get rid of them on a federal level. It's not just turning it over to the churches. He also wants to turn it over to the responsibility to take care of the poor to the states alone. I don't have any objection to that. Here in Wyoming, we do a great job of both the state and the church.
Yeah, in Wyoming, you have a population that is largely heterogeneous. It's largely white. You have a population that is largely that is very small. You're about a million people in that state. Fewer than that. Okay, half a million. And
we're the smallest state in the union when it comes to population.
Right.
But we also have the sixth strongest economy.
And because you've got incredible natural resources. So I can understand why somebody living in Wyoming would say, hey, you know, we can take care of ourselves. We don't need to be supporting, for example, West Virginia or Louisiana or Alabama, where they don't have the natural resources and they do have a lot of poor people. But the fact of the matter is that in the days when we let the states, and this was, you know, pre-Civil War, in the days, and frankly, during most of the 19th century, in the days when we let the states make those decisions and take those responsibilities, what you got was states choosing not to let people vote, states choosing to let people die, states running basically what were, in effect, poor houses and prisoners for paupers, you know, criminalizing paupers.
Isn't that a way the people's fault? You know, it's like for a long time I've been debating on calling you on a proposition that you allude to quite a bit, and that's to go employee-owned in this nation rather than Wall Street.
Well, I'm all in favor of that, but let's not change the subject for just a second, and we just have a minute here until the break. But my point is that you shouldn't be punished, and it wouldn't be you because you're in Wyoming, but a person shouldn't be punished because of the place they were born. And that's what federalizing these programs does, is it says, as long as you're born in the United States, you're going to have an equal shot. You're going to be able to get food stamps if you're poor. You're going to be able to get free public education if you're poor, you know, regardless of that. Whereas it used to be, by accident of birth and geography, you could be really well off or really screwed simply by that accident. And that's fundamentally un-American, in my opinion.
Well, you know,
what Ron Paul's in favor of.
It's still a matter of, we also have the smallest voice, and so we have very little control.
That's not true.
Government.
You have 650,000-600,000 citizens, and you have two senators. The state of California has 38 million citizens, and it has two senators.
How many congressmen do they have?
Well, they've got a bunch, but, you know, so you add the senators and the congressmen together, and I would submit that you still have probably a 5-to-1 or a 10-to-1 voice over what the average Californian does because you live in Wyoming and because of the Senate. So I would disagree with that too, Joe. Thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service, find out what's the latest going on in Washington, D.C., plus your calls right after this.
I come in last night about 10:30. That baby of mine would let me in. Move it on over.
Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, radio, TV, whatever, the web, everything. And Talk Radio News is with us. It's brought to you, this report brought to you by the new book, Self-Empowerment, 9 Things the 19th Century Can Teach Us About Living in the 21st Century by Ellen Ratner and Ann Gaiman. And speaking of Ellen Ratner, Ellen?
Yes, I am here. Well, today the president, as we speak, in about 5 minutes, is going to be making a speech. It's going to be happening in Kansas, about 50 miles, about an hour's drive from where Teddy Roosevelt made his speech. And Jay Carney called this the make-or-break moment.
Wait a minute. Teddy Roosevelt made his speech on what?
He made his speech on something called the Square Deal.
Ah, okay. We actually have a clip from that, which we'll play later on, but go ahead.
Yeah, sorry about that. Okay, so Jay Carney today called it a make-or-break moment. He was said, well, Teddy Roosevelt was considered a communist, called a communist. What do you have to say about that? He said, listen, Teddy Roosevelt was hugely progressive, and used the word progressive leader, and a Republican.
Yes, well, that was back in the days when, you know, in the early 1910s and teens, probably the majority of progressives in this country were Republicans, you know, fighting Bob La Follette, you know, Teddy Roosevelt. There were other, I mean, there was a huge progressive contingent within the Republican Party.
Well, there isn't any more.
Yeah, no, there isn't. They've all been purged.
You know, you remember that Clinton used to talk about people playing by the rules. Well, apparently the president is also going to be talking about people engaging in fair play and doing their fair share and therefore being able to get a fair shot. And so that's really where his focus is going to be today.
Okay, so from Square Deal to New Deal to Fair Shot, I'm not sure that's the best use of language.
Well, he may use something else, but that's all they would say
in
the preview up to the speech. And again, it's going to happen in about a few minutes, so we'll find out from there. It is also interesting, the president, or Jay Carney today, was asked on the plane, Air Force One, about military action in Iran. He says that he's been referring all the questions about Iran to the State Department, but he was said, well, is the administration thinking of engaging in that? The only thing he would say, but I thought it was his denial was kind of interesting, or sort of denial, he said, we don't take any options off the table. And that was in terms of Iran.
Yeah.
President also, Carney said that he will stay here for Christmas if necessary. As you know, he's been criticized for taking a rather long vacation in Hawaii this year. But he said, well, if he needs to stay here to make sure that the House and Senate do what they need to in terms of payroll tax, he will stay here.
Well, that makes sense, both politically and policy-wise, I suppose.
Yes. Now, there has been something else really interesting today. The president issued a memorandum to have all agencies and all foreign assistance diplomacy accepting human rights of LGBT, gay, lesbian, bisexual, transsexual. And they said that this is the first ever list that has gone out on human rights abuses. Particularly, they want to combat criminalization of being a gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and they want to leverage any foreign assistance. And they said that the United States, and this is issued as well by the State Department today, to have swift response on any human rights abuses for gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender.
That's great.
So first time ever. Also first time ever, this administration is really getting it. They are having today a White House conference. This is going to be a series of regional conferences on faith-based issues. and it is called the Regional Connecting Communities for the Common Good Conference. It's taking place at the University of Illinois. The mayor, Rahm Emanuel, is participating today, and they're getting a lot of faith-based local groups involved. So they're trying to take ownership of this faith-based thing and not let it just be a Republican issue.
That's great. You know, it's every religion preaches basically that we should be caring for the least among us. It just makes sense. It's always seemed absurd to me that moral ground, moral is maybe the wrong word, that the religious ground has been ceded to the right, when in fact they're the most antithetical to the core principles of the world's major religions.
For sure. Also today, the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, having a very long acronym, they endorsed Obama as the only choice for the 99%.
Yeah.
Now, there is something called the REINS, R-E-I-N-S bill. I don't know if you've been talking about it. It is from it's called the Regulation from the Executive in Need of Security Act. Now, obviously, somebody left the reins bill because it means taking the reins or reining in. So they came up with this crazy name for it. But what they want, the House and Senate, is to approve any regulation that would cost more than $100,000 or $1 million? I can't remember what it is. But anyway, I think it's $100,000. Whatever it is, it's an amount that the Republicans want to put on the executive branch, and saying it's $100 million, whatever it is, about separation of powers. And the president is clearly going to veto it. This is a separation of powers issue for the White House. And what they want to do is they want to stop the White House from regulating, which is an executive branch power, as you well know.
Yes, and a power also granted to them by legislation. I mean, not just conferred in the Constitution, but also legislative.
Any president would veto it.
Yes,
any president would wind up vetoing. Now, also, Hillary Clinton, Secretary Clinton, is in Geneva today, and she is meeting with the Syrian National Council, which is sort of the opposition group. She has appraised them as trying to reach all minorities and having a universal rights for all citizens in Syria. Meanwhile, we decided to return Ambassador Robert Ford to Syria, saying that his job is to give the United States message on all of this to the Syrian people.
Yeah, well, let's all hope that the Syrian situation can be resolved quickly, because people are dying there every day. It's
for sure.
Ellen Ratner, thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Brought to you by Self-Empowerment, 9 Things the 19th Century Can Teach Us, by Ellen Ratner.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. What does a seasoned and experienced politician think when he looks at the bizarre nature of the Republican primary and some of the Democratic politics in this country as well? Independent governor, former governor Jesse Ventura, the 38th governor of the state of Minnesota from 1999 to 2003, the author of 6 books, his most recent 63 documents the government does not want you to read. He's the host of True TV's Conspiracy Theory with Jesse Ventura, and his website, weaintgottimetobleed.com. On the line with us, Governor Ventura, welcome back.
Hi, Tom. Great to be back. I apologize for last week when I was supposed to be on. It was strange. I was in the middle of another interview, and there were 3 beeps on my phone, hardline, and it went dead, and it took a day to fix it.
Ah, okay. Well, you know, maybe it was the FBI. Who knows?
I don't know.
Or the aliens.
I'll tell you, you do conspiracy theory, the TV show, and you become paranoid of everything.
It was the pigeons. But that's a whole other rant. Anyhow, if the Republicans want to turn our political system into a reality show, here we've got Donald Trump and Newt Gingrich, you know, and the solution to childhood poverty is to pick 10 poor kids out and let one of them win the lottery. And the solution to childhood poverty is to take poor kids and have them clean the toilets of their wealthier peers in their public schools. And then he's going to do this reality show, and Huntsman and Ron Paul have said this is beneath the dignity of the presidency. But, you know, why not just toss them on a remote island, throw in Grover Norquist, their lord and protector, and, you know, let them play Survivor for a few weeks and see who comes out alive.
Well, you know, it really, to me, Tom, it's a flash of what our society has turned into today. Entertainment.
Yeah.
They're now turning our political elections into entertainment. They're out for ratings. Probably the networks are involved in that. The higher the ratings, the more money they can bring in. And I think it's part of the corporate takeover of what's happening in the country. They're turning our elections into a fraud if they're not there already.
I absolutely agree with you. And in fact, I noticed this first in the 2000 election, in the coverage leading up to it. And it was even more obvious in the 2004 and 2008 elections as emerged not just voices on the right, you know, Fox News and the mainstream media, but also voices on the left with MSNBC and others, that it seemed that the really corporate media, the large media machines, whenever in the primaries or in the general election, let's just take the general election as an example, whenever one candidate, Republican or Democrat, was up, they would have on people trashing him. Whenever the other one was down, they would have people lifting them up, always trying to maintain this 50-50 horse race, which gets more and more people. I mean, everybody loves a 50-50 horse race. If it's obvious that one candidate's going to win, people don't tune in. They don't get as many eyeballs. They don't make as much money from advertising. Does that conspiracy theory make sense to you, Jesse?
Well,
Governor?
First of all, let me state, let's clear something up. When you say something conspiracy theory, right away there's a connotation that you don't believe anything and that all of this. I always counter that by saying, let's remember something. Gravity's also a theory.
Yeah, well, I don't mean this as
off the building. You can find out it's real.
Yeah, I see this as the natural outcome of back in 87 when Reagan did away with the Fairness Doctrine, and in 96 when Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act. And it was after 96 when Clinton signed that the all three networks used to have standalone news divisions that lost money because they did such a good job of reporting and gathering the news. They had bureaus all over the world. They all moved them into under the arm of the vice president of entertainment. And so they are all now run by their entertainment divisions. And we no longer have news. We have infotainment.
Yeah. And also credit 60 Minutes for that.
How so?
Well, 60 Minutes was the first. They did some good work on there. Don't get me wrong.
Oh, back in the day.
Yeah. But they were the first news reporting show that got ratings. So the light went off with the bean counters. They said, well, you mean we can make money with the news? And right. It was at that critical juncture that the news no longer was into enlightening you or informing you. It switched over to entertaining you.
And that would have been in what, the 80s, the 90s?
Back in that era. But, say, 60 Minutes, when it rose, because, I mean, every week on the top 10, 60 Minutes would be one or two in the ratings.
Right. What do you think?
It drew a huge audience, and that's when they said, you mean, that's when the switch happened where news used to lose money, and it was made up for in the entertainment division.
Right, and now news makes money along with
it. Now, all of a sudden, news can make more money, actually, than the entertainment division probably can.
Well, especially when they're promoting a movie that happens to be coming out from the same company that owns the parent company, or they're promoting a new weapon system that's coming out from the same company, or a war that's coming out from the same company that owns the news company.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
You know, I also want to hit, Tom, people need to be informed about my court case because they're not covering it. They're sliding it in.
This is your case against the TSA. Tell us
about
it.
Yeah, because what the ruling was this. The federal judge, and this has happened on multiple occasions now for everyone who tries to seek redress in some way at the airport, I sued under my Fourth Amendment rights. I was going to sue under the American Disabilities Act because of my hip. I'm technically disabled, but get this. The American Disabilities Act doesn't apply to the federal government.
Yikes. So you sued basically saying that the Chertoff X-ray porno scanners or the groping was an illegal violation of your privacy because you hadn't, there's no evidence that you'd committed a crime.
The key to the Fourth Amendment is the word reasonable.
That's right.
Reasonable search and seizure. And we were contending that it was not reasonable to believe to Jesse Ventura, who's been flying for 30 years. He's an honorably discharged Navy veteran. He's a former mayor and a former governor. Poses a threat. Well, what happens is it goes to the federal court, and it's happened in multiple cases. The judge rules they have no jurisdiction. Now, how can that be when it's a constitutional question? Well, what it is, then you have nowhere to go because the federal courts won't entertain it.
So the federal,
there's nothing you can do about it because it's a catch-22. They tell you you're supposed to go to the appeals court because they don't want me in front of a jury.
That's...
The appeals court is not a jury, of course, but how can you go to the appeals court when you haven't had a case?
Right, because they won't grant it cert. And
they want to stay away from allowing you to get discovery.
Right, so what are you going to do next?
Nothing. The only thing I can do is protest. So I said publicly, in light of when I was a young man, I saw John Carlos and Tommy Smith at the Olympics in 68 when they won medals for a country that wouldn't even allow them to drink at a white drinking fountain in the South. They had no human or civil rights. They stood up on that Olympic stand, bowed their head, and raised their fists in the air, and they were hated. They were thrown out of the Olympics. But today, I look back at them as heroes because they stood up for an injustice. They did it their only way possible. So I made the statement as a former Navy SEAL, I will not stand for the anthem ever again until I'm granted my day in court.
Wow. Now, we have just a minute left, Governor. What can people do at weaintgottimetobleed.com or elsewhere to support you in your case against the TSA? Or is that just
dead? That's interesting, Tom. I got no support. Where was the ACLU? Where were all these organizations that are supposed to be protecting our Bill of Rights? Nobody came forward in support of me. Nobody. I stood alone, like my second book, Do I Stand Alone?
Wow.
I felt like it.
Well, I'm with you.
Well, thank you. I know people are, but people need to wake up. They need to be aware, too, of this McCain-Levin bill, where they're going to call the United States a battlefield.
I know. It just got passed.
Here's what I want to say, Tom, to all veterans and current military personnel, remember, you took an oath to defend the Constitution and the Bill of Rights against all foes, foreign and domestic. Do not forget your honor.
Yeah, there you go. And domestic. Governor Jesse Ventura, weaintgottimetobleed.com, the author of 63 documents the government doesn't want you to read. Governor, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
Keep up the great work, sir. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So let's see. You go to federal court and you say my Fourth Amendment rights are being violated, and they say, oh, we don't do the amendments. We don't do the Constitution, but we're a federal court. I'm really confused.
Justice denied.
Welcome back to Occupy the Airwaves, the Tom Hartman Program. We're doing our best. What can I say? Let's see here. Gary in Chicago. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind today?
Well, the Ellen Ratner conversation, mm-hmm. You know, about taking back the religious theme from the GOP, there is no messaging of self-reliance and individualism in the Bible. It's all cooperation and self-sacrifice.
You're right. You're right. From Genesis right on through, and you're absolutely right. And so it just would make sense that, you know, progressive churches, progressive synagogues, progressives in period, who are people of faith, should be the ones, and the Democratic Party or the Green Party or whatever, you know, progressives in general should be the ones owning religion. I'm astounded that they're not. I mean, this is a conversation I had with Chris Hedges a while ago, and who calls himself a religious man or a Christian, and it's like there's been some. This is like the Frank Luntz saying that the inheritance tax is now the death tax, that billionaires are actually job creators. You know, it's they have done this by virtue of messaging and language, not by virtue of truth and actuality. And you just called out the truth, Gary. Thank you very much. Very, very well said. David in Morro Bay, California. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi, John. Thanks a lot for taking my call. Just heard your Jesse Ventura interview.
Mm-hmm.
Great guy. You know, in what he said, I'd like to make two points. One is that, you know, your comment about 60 Minutes being the turning point of the news
Yeah, that was his comment, not mine.
I saw Don Hewlett a few years back at Cal Poly at a forum, and I got to ask him a question, and the question was, what obligation does the news media have to democracy? And his straight answer to the whole audience was, none.
Now, Don Hewlett is who?
Don Hewlett was the producer of 60 Minutes. He was the main guy there.
Yeah.
And so that was his stance on what the news media owed the public.
Yeah, see, these guys need to read the Constitution. There is one industry, and you would think, you know, when they're putting together a new country, they would say, what's the most important industry in the country? Maybe it's cannonball manufacturing. I mean, this is 1787, right? Maybe it's cannonball manufacturing. Let's protect that in the Constitution or subsidize that in the Constitution. But no, they didn't do that. It wasn't arms. It wasn't cannonballs. It wasn't warships. It wasn't anything like that. It was the press. The press is the only industry which is mentioned in the entire Constitution.
No, absolutely, absolutely. And it's so important as Link TV and Free Speech TV shows. Without it, we're really sunk. But the other quick point I wanted to make was Jesse called veterans to hold up their oath. And I am a disabled vet, and I took that oath, and I've said that at many city council meetings and state council meetings that it's my job to stand up and tell you that you're wrong and you're doing something against the rules.
Right.
And, you know, if all of us vets stepped up and remembered that moment when we put up our hand and we, you know, in the face of war or whatever, and took that oath, that was a serious oath. And I haven't said the Pledge of Allegiance since Nixon. So there you have it.
And the oath is not to defend the country. It's to defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
And I get goosebumps every time I think about that oath. So
yeah,
I am a patriot, and I really, really am against the other big thing is this fixing of elections. Anybody voting on a DeBolt machine may as well just throw their votes in the trash because you don't know where they're going.
Tragically.
So
David, thank you for your service.
Jesse was inspiring.
Yeah, he's a good guy. Thank you very much, David, for your call. And Jimmy in Berryville, Arkansas. Hey, Jimmy, what's up?
Well, I'm having Mr. Hartman, I'm having a real hard time with trying to understand about the Bush tax cuts because it's been enforced over the last 10, 15 years. What was it? Goes all the way back to Ronald Reagan. And they're saying these tax cuts are going to be producing jobs.
Right.
And
they haven't.
What's their problem?
Yeah. There is no evidence that tax cuts produce jobs. In fact, if you look at the decade after Bush dropped the top tax rate from 39 to 35%, what we saw was a net loss of jobs. And, you know, he would blame that on 9/11 or something like that, or the Great Crash. I would say that the Great Crash was the result of that. And 9/11, you know, affected us for about a year, but not in that huge a way. So, you know, the Republicans have got a lot of excuses, but the bottom line is that the 3 decades where GDP for a 10-year period, for an entire decade, was over 3%. In fact, it was over 3.2% every single decade. The only decades in the history of the United States, 3 consecutive decades where GDP was above 3.2%, were the decade was the decade of the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, when the top tax rate was in the 74 to 91% top rate. As soon as that top tax rate got dropped in the 80s, decade by decade, GDP dropped below 3%, and it has stayed there to this day. And that's why I say, don't just roll back the Bush tax cuts, which you know, was just 39% going down to 35%. Roll back the Reagan tax cuts that took it from 74% down to that 35%. And you roll back the Reagan tax cuts, and people will have an incentive to keep money in their businesses and to keep money in this country and to grow their business and to hire more people rather than simply stashing it in a Swiss bank account or buying another yacht that's made in some other country. I mean, it's I think, frankly, common sense. And Jimmy, you nailed it. Thanks a lot for the call. You said it very, very well. And in fact, it's the title of one of the chapters in my book, Rebooting the American Dream. It's called Roll Back the Reagan Tax Cuts. And what blows my mind is here we are You know, there's this whole national dialogue about taxes and whether we should raise the taxes on the wealthy after their first $1 million by 2%. You know, why isn't anybody talking about rolling back the Reagan tax cuts? Because for 30 years, they've created a disaster.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And Ronald Reagan cut taxes, and unemployment went up to 11%, and he tripled the national debt. And you don't want to roll back the Reagan tax cuts? That would be the good, the bad, and the very, very inexpugnably ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain that helps remember good, big words. The good, Ruth Porat. Porat is Morgan Stanley's chief financial officer, and she is no bankster. That's because in a recent interview, Porat slammed rising wealth inequality in America and the low taxes rich people have to pay. She said, quote, "The wealthiest can afford to pay more in taxes. That's a part of the deal. That makes sense. I don't know anyone that doesn't agree with that. The wealth disparity between the lowest and the highest continues to expand, and that's inappropriate. We cannot cut our way to greatness." End of quote. Well said. Again, this is coming from the CFO, the chief financial officer at Morgan Stanley. We need more bankers like Ruth. The bad, Congressman Peter King. Tomorrow, as chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee, King will hold his fourth hearing on the threat of American Muslims. This time, he's focusing on Muslims in the military. Defending his decision to target American Muslims, King said, "There is an attempt by Islamists to join the military and infiltrate the military, and it's more of a threat than the average American is aware of right now." Let's see, what other congressman in the past warned that evil forces were infiltrating our military? Oh, yeah, Joe McCarthy. Maybe Peter King should take a look back at history and see what happened to Joe McCarthy, and then maybe he'd think twice about his witch hunt against American Muslims. And the very, very ugly, the police of London. Last week, the London police sent out a flyer to local businesses titled Terrorism/Extremism Update. The flyer included information regarding the threat of terrorism, noting that the threat is substantial. Included in the list of threats, Al-Qaeda, FARC in Colombia, and extremists in Belarus. Oh, and also Occupy London. The flyer accuses Occupy London of engaging in hostile reconnaissance and asks business owners to remain vigilant and report any unusual Occupy London activity to the police immediately. That's right, the peaceful activists who are camping out as part of the 99% movement are now on the same list as Al-Qaeda, according to the police of the city of London, England. Now, that's very, very ugly. Okay, during the break, I checked out what's going on with these with Jerry Brown's effort to raise taxes on the rich by voter referendum. Turns out that there are five, maybe six, individual ballot measures that are going to be on the ballot this fall in California to change the tax code. One of them is a wackadoodle right-winger cutting taxes, and the rest are various versions to raise taxes, mostly on wealthy people. One is being promoted by apparently the Progressive Caucus. I don't have all the details on this. One is being promoted by the governor himself. And then there's a couple others from independent groups. And here's the problem. If each one of the, you know, setting aside the wackadoodle one that says let's cut taxes, you know, they're trying to redo Prop 13. That ain't going to happen. But the ones that raise taxes on rich people, if there is more than one when it finally gets to the ballot, history shows that what happens is voters tend to say, look, there's all these, you know, I have to make a choice among five different ways to do the same thing. I'll just say no to all of them because I can't, you know, I don't have the time to study this and figure out, you know, which one's better than the other. And they're doing essentially the same thing. And so they fail. So, I don't know. Keep an eye on this, and we'll keep an eye on this, on what's going on in California. I think this is going to be very interesting. We'll see where it goes and how it goes and all that kind of thing. But anyway. Yosef in New York City, it says you disagree with me about something. Hey, Yosef, what's up?
I don't disagree with you.
Oh.
Okay. Yeah, no. You got the wrong guy. I was just giving you a report about Occupy Wall Street's effect in New York.
Okay.
Yeah, so I've listened to you every day for 3 years podcasting, and I really enjoyed your smackdown of that corporate Christian guy yesterday, the corporate Jesus guy.
Oh, thank you.
You had me cheering in the lab. That was awesome. Anyhow, so I just wanted to report to you that Governor Cuomo, who was previously against extending a millionaire's tax and wanted to close down schools and cut social services, has now this week come out and said that he is going to no longer take that position and propose fairness in our tax system.
Right.
So,
this is how the Occupy movement has changed the dialogue in this country. We're not hysterical about the debt anymore that Reagan and Bush ran up. Instead, we're now talking about the inequality and the huge tax cuts that they gave to billionaires and that has produced this inequality in our country. And that's such a good thing. You know, it's such a good
thing.
Yeah,
I mean, he's no Spitzer, but he's coming around and is supporting the progressive tax rate that even Nixon apparently was more progressive than some of these Democratic governors who think that they could just cut stuff.
In some ways, you know, some people like to idealize Nixon. They say, well, Nixon brought us the EPA. Actually, Nixon vetoed the EPA. Congress pushed it over. You know, they overrode his veto. But you know, Nixon was certainly more progressive than any of the Republicans out there. But, you know, we'll just leave Nixon in the distant past, but I think it's a great thing that Democrats are starting to be pushed in the right direction. This is the classic example, Yosef, and you identified it perfectly. Movement politics drives institutional politics, not the other way around. So if you really want to be the engine that moves things, join the movement. Yosef, thanks so much for the call. Renee in Judith, Wisconsin, you're on the air.
Yes, I just had a question because we were talking about the European economy starting to collapse and S&P going to downgrade them. But still, wasn't that our fault when our economy started to collapse that we shipped all these exotic things over there and they're left holding the bag, and because their banking system is different than ours that it creates the mess that they have now?
It's a little more complicated than that, but there is some truth to that. The American banking system, when it was deregulated in 98, 99, and 2000 with Gramm-Leach-Bliley, which blew up Glass-Steagall, and with the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, you know, with the Enron loophole, all these things brought to you courtesy of Phil Gramm and his wife Wendy, who was on the board of directors of Enron, and all basically promoted for the benefit of Enron, which was in the process of becoming a bank. As General Electric did, as General Motors did, as many big corporations did, that when that happened, American banks started took about $1.7 trillion. That was the full size, the total extent of all the subprime mortgages sold in the United States. They took these $1.7 trillion worth of mortgages and turned them into hundreds of trillions of dollars worth of derivatives, of bets that derived their meaning, their underlying value from those original mortgages. And then they sold those, and they were rated by S&P, by the way, as AAA, you know, investment grade things, just like, you know, U.S. Treasuries. All of the ratings, these are private corporate rating agencies. I mean, I think we need government, you know, rating agencies, but that's a whole other thing. And they sold those to many European countries. One of the first places to go bankrupt, in fact, as a result of Wall Street, as a result of these derivatives becoming unraveled, was a little town in Norway, and
that had
put all their pension in that, a Johannesburg or something like that, and so, yeah, that was one of the precipitating events. The UK had, to a large extent, deregulated their banks as well, because they wanted London, Fleet Street, they wanted them to keep up with Wall Street, and so many of the London banks were engaged in this, and the EU, in their rush to make all the banking systems interrelated and our deregulation allowing Deutsche Bank, for example, to have a major presence here in the U.S., so the Deutsche Bank U.S. office could be making derivatives that then would be sold in Germany. You know, there's like all these ways that they got interconnected, and all this crap basically got sold into Europe. And Europe, much of what's going on, much of what has to do with the failure in Europe is coming out of that. But the other thing that's happening is that once that bump happened, then the followers of Milton Friedman and von Hayek and these neoconservative or neoliberal, actually, is what it's referred to in Europe, but I would call them, you know, hard right-wing conservative economists. Their teachings are the ones that are being pursued by the Central Bank of Europe and by, you know, by the banksters in Europe, but in particular the Central Bank, the European Central Bank, the ECB. And they're saying to the countries, you have to go on an austerity program. It's the same thing that the conservative government of David Cameron is doing in the United Kingdom. Let's cut government, let's cut programs, and somehow that's going to, you know, sprinkle magic fairy dust on the economy, and the economy is going to get better. And what, in fact, happens is when you cut government and you cut programs during a downward spiral, it throws more people out of work, and those people, A, are no longer earning income and no longer paying taxes, so tax collections go down, and then those people apply for unemployment benefits, and so government revenue, government spending goes up, and it creates a downward spiral where the debt gets worse and worse and worse. And, you know, even as the evidence of this is becoming so obvious, these people are just holding desperately to their belief that if they could just cut enough, eventually, you know, the magic fairy dust will work. And quoting Paul Krugman here, he talked about the, you know, they believe in the austerity fairy, I think he called it, that somehow that's going to, you know, change everything. And it's not. It's making the situation worse. We have, you know, part of the rationale is that we did this to Chile, you know, 60 years ago. We did it to Nicaragua. We did it to Honduras. I mean, the IMF has been doing this for years and years and years, following this ideology. So it's become an ideological thing. And it's just simply wrong. We had Steve Keen on this program for a full hour last week explaining this. You can see it at TomHartmann.com, a couple of YouTubes about it. So it is a disaster waiting to happen, because of ideology in large part, Renee.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And how do we change that ideology? Well, I think waking people up to it is a good first step. These economists, many of these economists, are just plain old flat out nuts.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay.
Yes, and it's coming by virtue of our efforts, your efforts, my efforts, all of us. We need to get involved. Steve Justino is with us. He is an attorney, and he is the co-chair of Move to Amend and the MTA National Action Coordinator. MoveToAmend.org is the website. And just a quick announcement here, Move to Amend, where Occupy the Courts is this next effort. Tom Hartman, that's me, and Dr. Cornel West are going to be featured speakers in front of the U.S. Supreme Court on the 20th of this month, on January 20th, as part of a National Day of Action to Occupy the Courts. And Steve has more information on that. Steve, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Tom. First of all, I just wanted to say what an honor it is to be on your show. Like a lot of people involved in this fight to end corporate personhood, I first learned about it by reading Unequal Protection, and it's a book that I just strongly recommend to anybody who's interested in how corporations became people under the Constitution in the first place.
Thank you, Steve. By the way, I misspoke. I didn't. It's not the 20th of this month. It's the 20th of January. So it's the 20th
correct.
Of next month.
Correct. And I'm co-chair of Colorado Move to Amend, and I'm the National Action Coordinator for Occupy the Courts.
Okay.
And thank you so much for agreeing to speak for us in front of the Supreme Court on January 20, 2012. Your listeners probably know that is the day before the anniversary of the Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission case, the second anniversary, and Move to Amend is organizing a nationwide day of protest in front of federal courts across the country to express our outrage over Citizens United and the concept of corporate personhood. And that action will include the Supreme Court. And right now, Tom, there are 46 other cities across the country that have committed to having some sort of an action in front of the federal court in their city or town. So
that's
great. It's growing exponentially.
That's great. And if you want to find out if it's in your city and show up, or if it's not happening in your city, And the federal courts in your where you may live, go to movetoamend.org, and you can get all the information there. Right, Steve?
Absolutely. Movetoamend.org/occupythecourts will take your listeners to our national interactive map. We'll show you where the 46 cities are, and if there's not one in your town, your city, by all means, organize one. There are only 100 federal courts in the United States, including the Supreme Court, including the Courts of Appeals. We're almost in front of half of them now. I would love to see us in front of 50 or 60 courts, if not all of them, by January 20th.
That is spectacular. That is spectacular. Steve, thank you very much for the heads up and for the great work that you're doing at movetoamend.org/occupythecourts, right?
Yes.
And please keep it up. Thanks for dropping
by. Thank you
so
much, Tom.
Good talking with you. Thank you. And that's going to be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to Cornel West and I were the two of several of the keynote speakers at the Fighting Bob Fest in Madison. Last time I saw him, it was a few months ago. I look forward to seeing him again. So let's see here. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. Dorothy in Dawson Springs, Kentucky. Hey, Dorothy, what's up?
Well, I'll tell you, there's a lot's up. I have a comment on this. They're trying to settle our budget over the United States. For one, all the money up in the government does belong to us, you know.
Well,
and we pay those people's salary.
Yep.
We pay all of them salary. They forgot that. We don't work for them. They work for us.
Yep.
But we never have a house cleaner. And that's a dirty shame. Now, they're wanting to cut everybody else's salary. Why don't they? Each one of them, just think how much money, each one of them would save the United States and clear that budget if from the president on down to everybody that worked for the government took a pay cut.
Well, they have had a pay freeze for 3 years, and they're going to freeze their pay again this year.
Yeah, they froze it. Somebody else could get part of what they got.
Yeah.
But I want them to take a cut after that freeze, you know.
Well, here's the problem with that, Dorothy. I understand your outrage, and I share it. But if you make it so that the average person can't quit their job and become a member of Congress and still, you know, raise their family. And being a member of Congress pays about $160,000 a year, which sounds like a hell of a lot of money. But you have to live in Washington, D.C., where, you know, a cheap apartment is $2,000 or $3,000 a month. Well, maybe a cheap apartment is $1,000 a month. But, you know, in any case, you've got to live in Washington, D.C., where it's expensive to live. And you've got to also live back in your district. And you've got to fly back and forth. And you've got a lot of expenses associated with that. So I'm not of the opinion that these people are overpaid. My concern is that it costs them $1 million to run for reelection. And so they're spending half their time raising money for their reelection. Forget their salary. If we were to say, okay, you know, we're only going to pay $20,000 a year to members of Congress, you know who the only people you'd have in Congress would be millionaires and billionaires. And that's not the kind of Congress you want. So, you know, right now it can be you can make a living being a member of Congress. That's a good thing.
You said that's not the Congress we want. That's the kind we've already got. Nobody but a millionaire ever gets in there.
Well, you've got only about half of most of the United States Senate are millionaires, but only about half of the House of Representatives. And when Reagan came into office, it was only just a couple of the House of Representatives were multimillionaires. So, you know, cutting the wages of members of the House and the Senate will simply increase the number of millionaires and billionaires. I'd rather cut, you know, what it costs to run for public office. So let's do public funding of campaigns and get all the corporate and billionaire money out of politics. And then these people can actually do the job that we're paying them to do rather than spending 4 hours a day raising money. Does that make sense?
Well, partly, but I still say they get too.
You
much
still want to kick them upside the head.
I still want to kick them out and start all over again.
Okay. Dorothy, I understand. I absolutely understand. And thank you for calling and sharing your sentiment with us, even if I can't change your mind. Coming up tomorrow, a former Chase bankster recently admitted that his bank purposely pushed minorities into subprime loans. Homeowners are in foreclosure. The banksters are getting bonuses. Business as usual. I'm going to challenge conservative Wall Street Journal economics writer Stephen Moore on this. Plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up, when you participate. Get out there, tag, you're it. Occupy something. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.